Well, this is Focus 580. It's our television, our telephone talk show. I guess occasionally I do television talk shows, but this is the show that we do here on the radio every morning. And in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Michael Waldman. He was President Clinton's director of speechwriting from 1995 until 1999. He also served as special assistant to the president for policy coordination from 1993 until 95. Previously, he was a public interest lawyer and writer. Since leaving the White House, he's taught at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he's authored a book about his experiences in the White House. The title is POTUS Speaks, and we should explain that odd word in the title. POTUS stands for President of the United States. So the title, POTUS Speaks, Finding the Words That Defined the Clinton Presidency. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. As we talk with Michael Waldman, your questions are welcome. You can certainly join the conversation by calling the usual number, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. If you call those numbers to call into the show, no one will expect you to pledge. We hope, of course, you will. It's not required to call into the program. So do join the conversation if you like, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. And at any point, you're certainly welcome to do that. Mr. Waldman, hello.
Hi, my pleasure.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us today. One thing I am indeed curious about, around the White House, do they actually use POTUS as a word? Do they talk?
Sometimes. Use that? In memos about scheduling or things like that, less frequently in actual conversation, but the Secret Service do use that. For example, the room where the president is supposed, any president, this is not just this president, where the president is supposed to wait before going out to give a speech is called the POTUS hold. So it's a little bit of mystery.
I think the first time I ever saw that was in reference to the vice president, who is V. POTUS. I saw that in a news story, and it jumped right off the page at me just because it looked so sort of odd. And I definitely was curious about whether people actually,
with a sort of a wry sense of humor, they do. And the first lady is sometimes called FLOTUS, and people in Washington actually do call the Supreme Court of the United States SCOTUS.
Okay. In the book, in the afterword, you tell a story of having invited to the White House Ted Sorensen, who worked for JFK, for John Kennedy, to meet with the White House speechwriters, and you explained that you asked for his advice, and he said right off the bat, well, I would get rid of the Department of Speechwriting. And then he went on to...
Which was terrific for morale.
I'm sure. You bring in somebody and says, well, the first thing I would do is fire all of you guys. And you asked him about his experiences and what happened in the Kennedy administration. And he explained, well, if the president was going to give a speech about agriculture, the Secretary of Agriculture would write the speech. And then you went on and said to him, well, how many speeches were written for the president at that time? And he said, maybe one or two a week. How many speeches were written for President Clinton?
Well, you're exactly right. In this day and age, it would be one or two a day.
That's a stunning amount of material to have to turn out.
Well, it really is. It is a huge volume of speeches that have to be written, and it really signals a very fundamental change in what it means to be president. Increasingly, the sheer volume of speeches and public appearances, the use of the bully pulpit, has become ever more central to what it means to be president. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, we said to Ted Sorensen, well, didn't Kennedy go out in the Rose Garden? We know he shook Bill Clinton's hand there. You know, he did go out to greet visiting groups. And Sorensen said, sure, but he wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't give him written remarks for something like that. Well, right now, because of the change in the way the media operates, if Clinton or any other president walks into the Rose Garden, his remarks will probably be broadcast live nationwide by any one of four competing 24-hour cable networks, dozens of internet sites. It's a complete change in the way a president can try and lead.
I suppose that is for both a curse on the one hand, and perhaps also one of the tools that the White House has on the other, the fact that anything the president says at any time, you know, is going to be news and will be reported on and repeated from coast to coast.
Well, yes, that's true. You kind of have to take the media environment the way it is and not worry about it too much. But you're right that it's positive in that it's still the case that only the president has the ability to speak to the entire country. So that I remember, for example, during the budget negotiations and the government shutdown in 1995, Clinton was able to do a lot of his negotiating in public through a terse statement that he would give that would be broadcast live, and Congress really would have a much harder time because there's still 535 members of Congress. But at the same time, it really makes it much harder for it made it harder for Clinton, and it makes will make it harder for any president to speak to the whole country. Hmm. At the same time, CNN and Fox and MSNBC and all those folks are broadcasting this stuff, presidents can no longer easily give Oval Office addresses to the whole country. The TV networks won't broadcast them or negotiate endlessly over the topic. Well, if it's a war, that maybe we'll broadcast that, or if it's a sex scandal, certainly. But other than that, there's no guarantee at all that they'll run an Oval Office address.
Yeah, you probably could no longer do a fireside chat, even if you wanted to.
Oh, that's right. Well, for example, earlier this year, Clinton wanted to give an Oval Office address on U.S.-China relations. Now, everybody knows that may be the most important foreign policy question of the next 30 years, that rivalry and relationship between our two countries. And two out of the three networks said no. What are you, crazy? It's sweeps month.
Apparently you worked on, either you wrote or edited, something like 2,000 speeches, including, or perhaps in addition to that, the State of the Union addresses that Mr. Clinton gave and two inaugurals. This is a tremendous amount of material, and I'm sure that that it's a challenge to make sure that these speeches have a consistent voice, both in terms of content and style. And I wonder just how much the president himself is involved in this process.
Oh, yeah. A presidential speech is more than just a string of sound bites or applause lines. It's really where presidential personality and politics and policy all come together. And that was especially true with Clinton because he was so very heavily involved in crafting his own words and deciding what to say, which is one of the things that I think has been a benefit in terms of writing this book, because it really gives a window not just on Clinton as a distant figure, but really up close. He was giving speeches long before he'd ever met a speechwriter, and would be very heavily involved in the writing of speeches, especially the big speeches like State of the Union addresses. If we were going to give him if he was supposed to deliver a 30-minute speech, the draft we would give him usually would run about 15 minutes. In other words, he would double it. Hmm. He's to tell the new speechwriters, we give him Hemingway, he turns it into Faulkner. and he would add a lot, and he would especially at the podium extemporize and ad lib and read the crowd and sense when people were not persuaded of something or maybe when they agreed with something, and really put himself into it in that way.
And I know that that's something that probably at least early on in his presidency, some people, depending upon how you felt, either that was a subject of ridicule or perhaps some people thought of it as a constructive criticism. They would have said to him, Mr. President, I think perhaps you've gone on a little too long, or you have this tendency to give speeches that have too much in them, that go on too long. Were there times when you said to him, I think perhaps it would be better if we made this shorter rather than longer?
Oh, sure. And the joke of it, of course, is that he he was very aware of it too. He just when we would give him speech with when he would come across what he regarded as just some empty rhetoric, some high flown language, he would cross it out and say, "Words, words, words." And he used to walk in after working all, late at night on a speech with he counting how many words he'd cut out, and then of course he'd add in twice as many. But you know, it's interesting. After the first few years, he really found his voice, and found a way to give these speeches that were long and chock full of policies, and some people said they were a laundry list, but which actually worked very well and which really connected with people. And with Clinton, it was always the case that his speeches were long and had a lot in them. And the commentators and pundits afterwards very frequently would say, "Oh, that was terrible. It was just a laundry list." But then it would turn out that the public loved it. And Clinton sensed that what people wanted in this kind of post-Cold War era was there was not one big issue. What people wanted was a real report on all the things their government was doing. And that often meant going in great detail into policy. But he had a pretty sure sense of how to connect with people on that level.
Mm-hmm. I think that maybe this is of course a gross generalization, but if you look at some of our recent presidents and you look at their rhetorical style, their manner of presentation, we have had some that were really detail guys, and I think that President Clinton is one, and some that were perhaps better or more inclined to articulate broad vision, sometimes maybe a little vague, but they were definitely not detail guys. And yet both of these styles can be very persuasive, and I think perhaps two good examples are Ronald Reagan on the one hand and Bill Clinton on the other. Both of them, oh, I don't know if anybody's called Bill Clinton a great communicator, but both of them, I think, very skillful communicators and good speech makers, but of course both of them very different. Do you have some sort of sense about how one steers a course, in a sense, between those two? Because you have to have a little bit of, ideally, I guess you'd want to have a little bit of both.
Well, I think that's actually it. I think Reagan's speeches were far more prosaic than we remember, mm-hmm. and Clinton's speeches, when you go back and look at them, were more had more beauty than we remember. Even when I go back and think about some of the speeches and then I hear them again, I think, oh, that actually was quite uplifting, not just all the policies. I used to go back and look at Reagan's speeches quite a bit, and you're right that he was masterful in so many ways. And I remember when we were having the government shutdown in 1995, I wanted to see how Reagan had handled the same issue. I looked in his remarks the day the government shut down, instead of being something, you know, very high-flown about a shining city on a hill, he said, "Today I have returned to the Congress without my signature, H.R. 2911, the supplemental appropriations legislation, for the following five reasons." In other words, he recognized that part of what a president does is speak the language of state. He's really is speaking for the government as well as trying to capture the country's ideals. I think that the need to have both elements really has been shown in some ways by the debates, the past three debates. I think that Clinton both had the empathy and the policy, and I think that in some ways, especially, say, in the first debate, Gore put out the policy but without as much of the human touch, and Bush was all human touch without a lot of heft on the policy. And it makes you realize you need to do both.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some callers, and I want to give them the opportunity to talk with us. Let's start right in with someone in Aurora, and this will be line number four. Hello?
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I often wondered about that. I'm really glad to be able to speak with you. How do you formulate a speech that has is going to be given by the president, does he come to you with a outline of what he wants to say and then you do the writing, or is it half and half? Just about how do you do it?
Well, it depended on the speech. In other words, after 2,000 speeches and working for him for 7 years, we had a pretty good, I had a pretty good sense of what he was going to want to say on most things, and he knew what I would need help on and less so on other things. Usually, we would meet with him once a week and go over what the policies and the messages and the arguments he wanted to make. And there'd be a lot of notes back and forth. But for an everyday speech, he often wouldn't take a look at the draft until 10 minutes before he walked out the door to deliver it. Now, he wouldn't then go out like a robot at Disneyland Hall of the Presidents. He would scribble in the margins, he would rewrite it, and he would ask lots of questions of the policy advisors or the speechwriters. It's a real chance for him to dig in and find out what the issue is. That's true for an everyday speech, but for something like, a State of the Union address, Quentin would block out weeks at a time on his schedule to work on virtually nothing else. Lots of trading outlines back and forth, drafts. He would dictate quite a bit. And then in the last few days before the delivery of a speech, he would rehearse at a teleprompter at a podium in the family theater of the White House and read through the speech and rewrite it as he went along. Say, you know, I don't want to say this paragraph this way. Let's say it that way. And in that way, make it all his own, basically. My job during all of that was to sit at the keyboard and try and capture all the changes that he was making.
Does a historian go over it to see that the facts are historically correct?
Not so. Sometimes if there's historical facts, every fact that is put in a speech for a president, at least in theory, is very rigorously checked.
Oh.
You use the Council of Economic Advisors or the Budget Office to check the economic facts. One of the nice things, as you can imagine, about being in the White House is you have the huge array of resources in the government. I sometimes think one of the problems for people on the campaign trail who get caught with anecdotes that don't check out is they just don't have the backup that that a president has. I'll tell you that it doesn't always work. There was one speech, which I write about in my book, which was the speech where he launched his fight for NAFTA, remember, the free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And he gave this big speech in the East Room of the White House with Presidents Ford and Bush and Carter standing there. And what had happened was he was handed somehow the wrong version of the speech. There was a version where all the facts were checked out, but he was handed the first draft with basically placeholder numbers. And he kind of realized about halfway through that something was wrong, but we spent quite a lot of time trying to clean up that mess.
I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I appreciate her call and her question. We'll go on to some other folks in just a moment, and we'll continue to talk with our guest, Michael Waldman. He was President Clinton's director of speech writing from 1995 until 1999, and has written about that in a book titled POTUS Speaks, Finding the Words That Defined the Clinton Presidency, published by Simon & Schuster. What we're going to do here is pause for just a moment. In fact, we're going to do something that we never do the rest of the year. We're going to interrupt this interview for a moment or two. One of the things that I appreciate maybe most about doing this show is that I don't have to do this the rest of the time. We generally have a 50-minute interview, these two blocks, do two of these every morning, and we go straight through. We don't stop. We don't pause. It's just you and me and the guest. We can do that only because this is public radio, meaning it's listener-supported. We don't have commercials. We couldn't even if we wanted to, and we're glad that we don't. because it gives us an opportunity to do all these things without interruption. But that is possible because listeners support it. And now, right now, this morning would be a great time, if you haven't yet done it, to make a contribution, 244-9455. Especially important here because this is the last weekday and we have a way to go to the goal. We're pretty confident that we're going to make it, but that means that we also need to have everybody call who listens, and if you haven't done it yet. One of our producers, Jack Brighton, is here with me in the studio.
Hi, David.
And also in Pledge Central, Heather Miller, and we can check with her and get a little progress report in a second.
I wanted to say that the goal for the week, first of all, is $100,000by Saturday. And we hope to meet that goal, but we can only do it if you call us with your pledge. Especially today is the last day that you can support Focus 580 very directly by making that pledge call, 217-244-9455. There's also another way that you can pledge, and that is online. We have made a lot of progress in developing our website over the past year, and I wanted to mention the election website, which maybe we haven't talked about enough, but you can go there and get everything that we produce related to the election is on that website. All the interviews, all the news features, even some television content is there. All the debates, the editorial board interviews, there's hours and hours of stuff that you can listen to, information about the candidates, links to further information about campaign finance, various other voting records, all kinds of things you can get to through our election website. And it's very easy to find that. If you go to our website, the homepage, www.will.uiuc.edu, and right up the top of that, it says Election 2000. Click on there, and it'll take you to the separate election website that we're producing. I'm really interested in people looking at it and telling me what you think. If you find it useful, let me know. You might like it. You might not. If you don't like it, let me know what's wrong and what we ought to do better. But while you're checking it out, also pledge online. There's lots of links to to the pledge page, a secure server. And every time we talk about this, we get people to make online pledges. So I want to make sure that we talk about it during this hour. And also just mention, by the way, an example of a station, KPLU in Seattle, held a one-day cyber pledge day on Wednesday of this week. In that one day, they raised $109,000 just from online pledges. I don't expect we're going to do as well as the Seattle station. We don't have the population for it. But, this is a very wired city, this area around here. A lot of people are listening to us online. And if you're doing that right now, please consider pledging online and just simply do it that way.
Yeah. Let's talk real quick with Heather Miller, who's in Pledge Central. Maybe, again, you can kind of tell us where we are right at the moment.
Hi, David. We are over $68,000 on our way to $100,000 by midnight Saturday night. We've taken two calls, 4 a.m., and we're waiting to hear from you. Martha's online and she's waiting. Kathy's waiting. Ann's waiting. Donda's waiting. So I hope that our listeners will stop their waiting and go to their phones, 244-9455. Make a membership pledge of $40 or $60. For Focus 580.
And that would be great. Jack, it was just a mention ago, the amazing results that the folks in Seattle have had. And I want to make a point again that I did right at the beginning, is that it has always been the case that for a station our size, mm-hmm. our listeners have responded in a fabulous, fabulous way. And that we've always had very healthy fundraisers, and that's something that we're really grateful for. But we need to have that continue and continue to grow the base of support. And every time we do one of these things, one of the things we do is say we have this goal for new folks, people who have not contributed before. So we're really looking for people who, if you're a supporter of the station, you can give us a call and make a pledge and be a, join on. Join this group we call the Friends of WYLO. So let me give you the number one more time, and then we get back to our conversation here with Michael Waldman. It's 244-9455, and we will talk again at the end of the show. Thanks, Heather. Our guest, maybe mention one more time, Michael Waldman. He was President Clinton's Director of Speech Writing between 1995 and 1999. He also served as Special Assistant to the President for Policy Coordination before that, between 93 and 95. And he's written a book about some of his experiences working in the White House, the title POTUS Speaks, P-O-T-U-S, which stands for President of the United States. That's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455. 945, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller up is Freeport, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Probably the greatest, most historic discourse was not written by any so-called presidential speechwriter, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. A classic oration, you might say, that will stand the test of time for hundreds of years.
Yes?
It'll stand the test of time for hundreds, maybe for thousands of years. Classic summation of American history. I also want to mention in passing that during the past week, a longtime figure of U.S. public life is gone. This was Gus Hall, head of the Communist Party USA. Wasn't hardly anything in the media about it, although ABC did a two-minute program on it at the end of their newscast in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Let me comment. Well, on the second point, it's interesting, just as a matter of, I'm always disappointed when I read obituaries of people, Gus Hall, I suppose, is one, but just how many people from the most interesting era of recent American history in some ways, you know, how many figures from the New Deal and the Truman administration are still with us and are passing away more or less unnoticed, and realizing that a lot of these folks are still here and, you know, you could go talk to them. But the caller is right that that didn't get that much attention. The Gettysburg Address is, in my view, along with King's speech at the Lincoln Memorial, the greatest American speech. And as far as we know, Lincoln did write it himself. Two interesting points. One is that Lincoln, and this goes to how the presidency has changed, Lincoln really only gave three major addresses during his entire presidency, his two inaugural addresses and the Gettysburg Address. He was very careful about not speaking in public unless he had something very specific to say. But even Lincoln, in his famous first inaugural address, had help from his speechwriter, as it were, who was Secretary of State Seward, who wrote the first draft of the peroration of that speech. Lincoln was one of the greatest prose stylists in American history, and there haven't been many presidents or speechwriters, for that matter, who come close. When President John F. Kennedy was preparing for his inaugural address, he asked Ted Sorensen to go read the Gettysburg Address and find out what was its secret. And Sorensen reported back, always never use two words when one will do. Never use a two-syllable word when a one-syllable word would do.
I think that is it, and it was made at a time when elaborate, high-flown, overblown, sometimes rhetoric was the order of the day. And perhaps what makes that speech stand out is that it's elegant, but it's also spare, and probably for the time was almost conversational, was really plain, sort of very plain spoken, which, whether it's true or not, is, I guess, when you think of Abraham Lincoln, that's the quality that you think of.
Well, there's another thing which has changed, and not for the better, and this is something I write about in my book. Back then, the audience that Lincoln was speaking to had a very clear set of common knowledge of great texts that Lincoln could make reference to. You know, when Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," it in Springfield, when he gave that speech in 1858 in Springfield, he wasn't coining a great soundbite. He was quoting scripture, and everyone in his audience knew that. You know, out on the frontier then, a lot of people they had very few books, and a lot of people were illiterate, but they knew their Bible, and they knew their Shakespeare. Nowadays, the only kind of common culture that we have, perhaps, is TV and movies. When John McCain says, "I'm Luke Skywalker fighting the Death Star," everyone knows what that means. Clinton has a very, to me, impressive understanding of the texts of American history, of scripture, of literature. He often doesn't get a chance to use it. I remember when Ron Brown was on a mission to Croatia and his plane crashed. You may remember that, along with a lot of other people whose lives were lost. You can imagine it was very upsetting to those of us who knew Brown and in the White House. And Clinton rushed up to Ron Brown's house, and we got a phone call from Alexis Herman, who was then a member of the White House staff before joining the cabinet. And she said, the president's going to the Commerce Department in a few minutes to speak to the employees there. Do you think you could write something up? And we said, well, sure, we'll try. Did or does, it's one of those moments where you don't know what tense you're supposed to use. Does Ron Brown have a favorite Bible passage or hymn? And she said, yes, he does. Da-da-da-da-da, gotta go, click, and hung up. Mm-hmm. And we had what she said was a Bible passage, but we hoped we'd copied it down right, and we didn't really know if we had it accurately. We didn't know if we had a real Bible passage. So we only had a few minutes, so we looked on the Internet, we thumbed through Bibles, we called priests and ministers, and we just could not find it. So we had no choice but to go over to the Commerce Department, and Clinton came in. It was a very emotional scene, and we went up to him, and one of my colleagues handed him the speech and said, Mr. President, we have something for you. There's only one problem. This Bible passage at the end here, we don't know if it's a real Bible passage. And Clinton looked at it and said, oh, Isaiah, this is the New English Translation. I prefer King James. That's the one I'll use. And, you know, you don't really need to do that, as president. I think the only time Clinton would walk into a room and not have to, in some measure, dumb down his speech. The only time he could walk in and know that the audience would get all the literary references and all the historic and scriptural references is in an African-American church, black church, even in the poorest community.
See, I think there you put your finger on something that that sets people shaking their heads about Bill Clinton, and whether they are supporters or detractors. That and it just contributes to the feeling that one really doesn't quite understand this man. That here we have someone who is a very intelligent man who, while he was in the White House, did some things that weren't very smart. And I think people just find it very difficult to come to grips with just that basic sort of contradiction. As someone who spent a lot of time with him and probably came to know him very well, do you feel that you understand this man?
I think that he's hard to understand in some ways. I think you've put your finger precisely on it, which is how could somebody as smart as him have done something as dumb as that? It's not as if he wasn't put on notice. In other words, but having said that, one of the things that I saw over the 7 years was actually, I think, quite a bit of growth on his part. He really learned the job of president. He really was quite orderly and very conscientious over the years, especially as time went on, in how he did the job. And in some ways, that was why when this personal stuff came crashing into the room, it really was it was quite a surprise to me and to a lot of people who worked with him. Maybe people who spent the time, who didn't know him up close but only knew the caricature, were less surprised. But I thought he'd put a lot of the personal turmoil behind him. You know, I do think there's two issues on character. And in the book, obviously, these issues come up. One is that I don't think he should have done what he did. I mean, I certainly don't approve of it. But I also think that in some ways the main difference between him and other presidents is that we know of his flaws in real time, whereas with the others we wait 20 or 30 years to find out from historians. Mm-hmm. Which is not to excuse them, but I think history will put it in some perspective. But then there's the other issue, which is sort of interesting, is, you know, there's a lot of talk about character. But there's an aspect of real character that I saw, which was given the situation, even a situation he had a lot to do with creating, he kept going. He really focused on his job and conveyed that very much to those of us around him, that we had to focus on our jobs, you know, on doing the public work. And that was actually quite something to see, especially in those first weeks of the Lewinsky scandal when the whole presidency was teetering, how he would sort of put his game face on and just work on the speech or work on being president was quite something. So I don't fully, you know, that's a long way of saying I don't entirely understand him, but I do think that, look, there's a million books that try to psychoanalyze him, and I don't know that we'll ever know that. But what there hasn't been enough attention on is what did he do or what didn't he do? Did he just coast through 8 years the way George Bush said, or did he have a successful presidency? And I think that's probably where my book makes more of a contribution. It's one of the first ones that actually looks at some of those questions.
We have some other callers, so let's see what's on their minds, what they would like to ask. We'll go to our Urbana person here, been patient with me. Line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I, too, appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and I think I'll buy the book. I've always thought Clinton was a wonderful speaker, my sense is that he has a wonderful memory and that helps a whole lot. I have two specific questions. One is related to what you were just talking about. I think it was his 1998 State of the Union address, so he was addressing a joint session of Congress, and that was when the Lewinsky scandal was just breaking. I still cite that speech. I teach public speaking, among other things, and I cite that speech for the sheer courage and effectiveness. I mean, he was wonderful in that speech, looking at an audience that was certainly hostile. Much of it was certainly hostile, and as you just said, the presidency was teetering. And I wondered if you could comment on that, and how he approached that, how he felt about it, what you all were doing to try to do.
Oh yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I do think that was probably the most vivid week of the whole presidency for me, for better and for worse. The other listeners might not remember that you're exactly right. The Lewinsky scandal broke 1 week before the State of the Union address in 1998, and it was the most intense and surreal thing, driving to work and having, you know, camera crews follow you in. It was a sense of siege. And I remember walking down the hall in the West Wing on the second day of the controversy, and the TVs were all tuned to the press briefing by Mike McCurry, the press secretary, and he was getting pummeled. He was just getting flayed. And my pager went off, and it said, call the Oval Office. And there had been speculation in the media that Clinton would resign, and I'd seen him the first day, and he seemed pretty shaky. And I called, and he didn't want to talk about what was on TV. He said, have you seen this memo from a professor with language for the State of the Union? And I really like this on page two. And we had a conversation. I hung up and looked back at the TV, and McCurry was still being pummeled up there. But bit by bit, after being shaky, as I say, the first day or two, he really pulled himself together and conveyed it to us, conveyed it to those of us around him. I mean, I do think that probably was one of the reasons he called me, was to very ostentatiously show me, a staff member, that he was still working on it. And this was a speech, if you remember, the budget agreement, the balanced budget agreement with the Republicans had just been reached in 1997, a few months before. But already, we realized there would be surpluses for the very first time in decades. Nobody had seen surpluses. Mm-hmm. And already in Congress, the Republicans who controlled the Congress were determined to spend the surplus on a tax cut. And Clinton thought, that this would be a bad idea, that it would potentially cripple the government well into the future, especially if the surpluses never materialized. And so we had a long process, which amazingly never leaked at the time, of deciding what Clinton should say you know, with Bob Rubin and the other cabinet secretaries, and so that when he walked into that chamber, and you're right, it was the lowest moment of his presidency. Nobody knew what he was going to say. People were wondering if he was going to resign or what would he, how could he just stand there? How could he do it? He got up there and he said, "What should we do with our brand new surplus? I have a simple four-word answer: save Social Security first." And the Democrats stood up and applauded. They were applauding, semicolons by this point. And Gingrich, Speaker Gingrich, thought about it for a moment, and he stood up and applauded. And the Republicans in Congress looked at each other and looked at Gingrich, and then they stood up and applauded. And at that precise moment, $1 trillion in the budget shifted from the column marked tax cuts to the column marked Social Security, and that's where it stayed ever since. And this was at the lowest moment of his presidency in terms of personal controversy and weakness of his own authority. It was one of the most effective uses of the bully pulpit I've ever seen from a president. So it really was a time of great juxtaposition of extremes, and I write about it quite a bit in the book.
Oh good. My second question concerns Al Gore, and I realize that you're not writing for him, but I'm getting fairly annoyed with him because he refuses to say the C word. Yeah, I mean, he's been in this administration for 8 years. He's been a part of these policies, which lots of people are very proud of, and so I'm increasingly frustrated with his unwillingness to mention President Clinton in any way, shape, or form. I'm wondering if you could comment just a bit on who's advising him about that, or rather, what kind of advice do you think he's been getting, that this is just, it's just altogether? Yeah. And do you have any comments with regard to that? I'd appreciate it. And I'll hang up.
And unfortunately, we don't have very much time to be able to give you to respond to the question there, Mr. Waldman. But we can give you a minute, I guess.
Sure. Well, there, I should say that, among other things, there's a very interesting article on this in the New York Times today about the relationship between Clinton and Gore and apparently the deterioration of it. He's got very good advisors. I think he is obviously. He wants to run as his own man. He wants to run in a way that he does not get somehow fingered for Clinton's ethical problems. I think that he was most effective in the third debate when he did finally start to say, you know, the past 8 years has been the strongest economy in generations, tremendous social progress, and the administration had a lot to do with that. I think that's not making it a referendum on the past, but it's saying, for example, a strong argument is that the size of Bush's tax cut is so great that it would threaten to bring back deficits, and we saw what happened before that. Before the past 8 years, you know, when they were out of control deficits, so I think he's beginning to say that, but I can't entirely explain it. I can't entirely explain it myself.
Well, you know, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop, and I should apologize. We had a couple of callers we just couldn't take, but here's where we will have to leave it. You can certainly, if you're interested in reading more on this subject, look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled POTUS Speaks, POTUS, which stands for President of the United States, by Michael Waldman, who was President Clinton's director of speechwriting from 1995 until 1999, published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Waldman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.